Okay, I'm joined by Ken Kellerman of the National Radio Astronomy Observatory and Dave Jauncey of the Australia Telescope National Facility. Welcome to the Jodcast. You were both involved in the early days of the discovery of quasars, I think. Can you just tell us a little bit about that?
More from the outside looking in, but Dave, why don't you start?
Okay, mostly from the periphery. I was at Sydney University and Cyril Hazard lived down the corridor. And it was sort of interesting because Cyril and John Davis had moved into, actually it was the room next to the, what used to be the ladies' toilet. And so, you know, it's easy to get to know people like Cyril. And watching the perspective from someone from Sydney University and using the CSIRO telescope at Parkes was interesting in itself. And so there were a lot of personal things. There was a lot of antagonism, in fact, between the various institutions at the time, which, in a way, I think has confused the situation. So most of my knowledge came from working on cosmic rays at the time, but seeing what was going on in Sydney University and also knowing most of the people, or many of the people over at CSIRO. So it's exactly as Ken said, it's an outside-looking-in perspective, but we both know most of the protagonists at the time. I guess we knew them fairly well. From the astrophysical side, I think it's a superb experiment. At the time, there were a number of problems that people were trying to address, and one of them was there was this so-called class of radio stars. A lot of the work, for example, at Jodrell, with the ever-increasing interferometers, had shown that there were a bunch of sources that really were very, very tiny. They weren't the big, bright galaxies. And so their identification was much more difficult because you can identify a big galaxy with a poor position. But for something which is very tiny, which nominally could have been a star, I mean, that's what they were called at the time, you need a position that's accurate to locate just this star and not the faint star next to it. So you really did need arc-second quality positions.
Right.
And there were a variety of ways going on to do that. One was at Caltech, which is where Ken was, and that was with the early Caltech interferometer.
Right.
And so with the interferometer, they were trying to measure positions. Now, the difficulty with doing that is you're sitting on the Earth, and so you're in a terrestrial reference frame, and if you want to locate an object on the sky to an arc second, you've got to be able to relate your reference frame to the celestial reference frame. And that was difficult to do because all that was identified was this bunch of big fat galaxies. And so the positions coming out of Caltech were typically what?
Seconds of arc. 3 to 5 seconds of arc, yeah.
Yes, but there were obviously some sources that the errors were much larger. And one
but
of those...
But there were some that were much smaller.
Yes.
Why don't you get on to the occultation?
Okay, I'll get on to the occultation. But Cyril Hazard, you'll read in Sir Bernard's books, etc. Cyril came with Hanbury-Brown from the Navy, and one of the nice things he started doing at Jodrell Bank is occultations. Now, that solves all of the problems at once.
So this is using something like the Moon?
This is using a telescope tracking the edge of the Moon.
Right.
Now, the position of the Moon and the Moon's limb is known with high precision in the optical reference frame, because that's where you see them. I mean, you know, you look up there at occult stars, you've got the measured positions of stars, so you know exactly, you can locate that limb, even with all the irregularities, with a precision of an arc second or better.
Right.
And it's in the right reference frame. And so what Hazard was doing at Jodrell, he'd done a couple of occultations of strong sources, but none of the very, very compact, you know, none of these point radio star style sources. And then Hazard was working with Hanbury Brown on the Brown Twist interferometer. He was working up at Narrabri, and Hazard, through Hanbury Brown, had made a connection with Taffy Bowen, who was the chief of the Division of Radio Physics at the time, to get access to the Parkes radio telescope. And the reason for making this push was that there were clear predictions, even given the poor quality of the position at the time of 3C273, that there was going to be a bunch over a space of, I think it was 61 through 62 or 63, a bunch of occultations of this very intriguing, because it was one of the strongest sources in the sky, was unidentified, and it was essentially a point source.
So what does the number 3C273 mean? Where does that come from?
It's about the 273rd source in the 3rd Cambridge catalogue. The 3C is 3rd Cambridge. I don't want to go into all the I mean, some sources get decimal points.
No, not in the 3C catalog.
Not in, okay, that was 3C.
It's the 273rd source
in the 3C catalog. Yes, but the 3C catalog was revised. Yeah, okay, that's a separate issue. And so there are some accounts, in fact, in the literature that say this occultation just happened to take place while they had the telescope. I mean, you know, that is blatantly wrong, because if you were not working for CSIRO, you just simply didn't get time on the Parkes telescope to point it around in the off chance that you were going to get occultations.
Right.
So, you know, this was set up well ahead of time. And as far as the astrophysics is concerned, there were a series of occultations that took place. And the nice thing about a series of occultations is it's like an interferometer. If Kellerman's nose is the radio source, the moon passes like that. So I get a 1-degree strip image of Kellerman's nose. And then if that's going in, and when it comes out from behind the moon, it comes out at a different angle. Right. So if you get a series of 1, 2, 3, or 4 occultations, you not only get intersections to give you the position, you can actually make an image.
Right.
And you can make an image if it's a strong source with a resolution sub-arc second. You know, the order of a tenth of an arc second, that sort of level.
Is incredible for a radio telescope, which...
In 1963, I mean, you know, this is 45 years ago. Yeah. It's difficult now. People routinely, you know, measure a position with tenth or a hundredth, and we're down in a milliarc second now. In those days, it really was very different. And so Hazard got this series of occultations. And I mean, you know, there's a whole set of legends that go with that, that are associated with Parkes and Hazard and all the rest of that. Leaving all of that aside, I mean, there's a lot of fun stories. But leaving that aside, the beautiful thing that came out of Hazard's occultation was he measured the position of this point source. And he also found, as with the various occultations, there was this radio jet. And so at the time, Minkowski was in Australia. And Minkowski, because of the relationship between John Bolton, because John Bolton had been at Caltech, had a 200-inch image of the 3C273 region. And so when they put the radio image on, not only did the position actually, with very high precision, agree with the star, also there was this optical jet that stuck out the side.
Right, so there's a radio jet and an optical jet.
A radio jet and an optical jet, plus this essentially perfect positional coincidence. So this is suddenly very, very different. Even with a few arc second positions, you worry whether it's that star, or, you know, there's an awful lot of blank field, or there's, you know, very faint objects. And so, you know, this in a sense it's really nailing it down. This had to be the identification. There were absolutely no equivocation.
And Ken, very, very quickly, because you want to go to the next session, can you just tell us about your involvement?
Yeah, well, I think my good friend Dave overstates the lack of accuracy in the interferometer position measurements. Prior to this 3C273 position measurement and optical identification, there were 3 or 4 other radio sources which had been observed with the Jodrell Bank interferometers to be very small, which did have accurate radio positions from the Caltech interferometer and had optical identifications. It was 3C48, 3C286, and 3C147, and I think 3C196. They were all, prior to this occultation, had been identified with stellar-looking objects. The question was, what were they? And they had complicated optical spectra. In one case, the 3C48, which was the first radio source identified with what we now call quasars, had a very complicated spectrum. Jesse Greenstein, who is an expert spectroscopist at Caltech, had analyzed the spectrum in great, or thought he had analyzed it in great detail, identified many of the lines with highly ionized states of
very rare
elements. He had a paper written, I guess he had submitted it to the Astrophysical Journal. And then came the 3C273 occultation and position. And the breakthrough was that 3C273 had this simple spectrum that, well, it wasn't as simple as just looking at, because it took even Martin Schmidt some time to realize that it was a simple hydrogen spectrum that was redshifted. So it was the simplicity of the 3C273 spectrum and the realization that it was highly redshifted that was the breakthrough.
So the spectrum of these objects look very different to stars. And
yes. And then, of course, and then they went back and looked at these other sources, realizing that there might be highly redshifted lines, and then going back and looking at it, and then being able to identify the lines with highly redshifted, highly excited states of things that were known to exist in nuclei.
There were two problems. I mean, I've stated the optical position problem. Ken stated the spectroscopic problem. Now, as somewhat of a counter to that, right at this sort of time, I think it was 3C296, was a galaxy, a compact galaxy, but a galaxy that had been identified with a redshift of 0.4 based on
295.
Okay. And so there's, you know, there are statements by some of the protagonists saying afterwards what they thought before, and thinking, you know, yes, the world should have been prepared for high redshift objects. And so in a sense you could say there was pre-information that this was a high redshift object, because Greenstein's...
But the mantle block was, they were the stellar, and they looked like stars.
Right. That's right. And, you know, this, so many things in science, at all levels, the last veil, if you like, of the seven to go, usually resides in people's heads. I mean, you know, yes, you can build the instruments, yes, you get the observations, but if you're not thinking correctly, and, you know, these, just looking at it this way, these are lovely ways of solving problems, because there was the spectroscopic problem, which finally got solved beautifully by Martin Schmidt, and, you know, that opened the last veil. Yeah. But all of these steps to get there, you know, were equally important. And, you know, one of the sad things, I'll say it, but these observations were done in, you know, from Parkes. Mm. And the sad thing to me is, looking back, you know, there were big telescopes in Australia. The 74-inch, for example, that were never used.
A big optical telescope.
Relatively
big. Big
enough. 3C273
is 13th magnitude. Well, 12th, 13th magnitude, yeah. You didn't need the 200-inch telescope.
You didn't need the 200-inch telescope. I mean, that's the crazy thing. Yeah. It's the brightest quasar in the sky.
Yeah. Now, one thing which we both circled around was why 3C273, which is a very strong radio source and a very bright optical object, why that could have been identified. And this is what Dave, I think, was alluding to, that could have been and should have been identified with the accuracy that was being obtained with the ground-based interferometers. You didn't need the occultation. And why that wasn't done, neither of us, nobody
we
understands.
Have no idea.
Had anyone optically wondered what the jet was that was coming from the side of
nobody
the
had noticed the jet till prior to Schmidt looking at it carefully because of the occultation position.
Yeah.
Now, he claims, or he states, that when he went to take the spectrum, because of the his experience with radio galaxies, he thought the jet was the optical counterpart and the galaxy. And he only took a spectrum of the stellar object to calibrate his system.
But he would have done it with a long slit spectrograph, yeah. Because all you do is you rotate it so that one part of the slit is on the star and the other part of the slit is on the jet. Well, you know, that's the sort of thing people relatively routinely do now. So, you know, once again, It's very easy. You can be right on the edge of opening a door and still not do it, just simply because you have preconceived ideas.
Well, I'm glad we unveiled those last veils, and quasars have been a great area of research for many years since.
Yes.
So thank you very much for joining us on the Geoscast. I'll let you go to your session today. Thank you.
Many thanks.